Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today one of the very early law bloggers out of the blogosphere, a fellow appellate attorney, Pennsylvania appellate lawyer, Howard Bashman. Welcome to the podcast, Howard.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're super happy to have you, and it's quite a treat for me as a longtime blogger myself to actually get to see you face to face, and such as it is on a Zoom call, and talk with you and learn more about your practice and how you got started and going with the blog. Before we launch into all that, tell us where you are, what you're doing, and just give us some background information on you.
Sure. I began as a journalist in high school and was fortunate to become the editor-in-chief of my student newspaper at Penn Charter in Philadelphia, which is a Quaker school. Supposedly, it had the first ever student newspaper in the United States going back to 1700 and something. And then I went to Columbia University in New York City as an undergraduate and wrote on the Columbia Spectator as a daily reporter. And then I was fortunate to go to law school at Emory University in Atlanta. And then I had a clerkship on the Third Circuit, which is the federal appellate court based back in Philadelphia, which is where I grew up. My judge was based in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, which is famous, among other things, for being the home of Yingling beer, you may have heard of. And it's in Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania, which is anthracite coal region. So that was an interesting 2 years I spent working for that judge. And then I was fortunate to get hired at a litigation law firm in Philadelphia that did not have an established appellate practice set up. But I was interested in doing appellate law, and we can discuss how and why that came about. And I was fortunate to be able to focus on that at that firm and become a partner there. And then around 2000, I went to another law firm, the Pittsburgh-based Buchanan Ingersoll Law Firm, in its Philadelphia office with a number of my partners from my prior law firm. And then in February of 2004, I became a solo practitioner. We can talk about how that came to be. In between there, in May of 2002, I started the How Appealing blog, which is the way that many appellate lawyers from throughout the nation know me. In addition to that, since the year 2000, I've written a monthly appellate column in a newspaper called the Legal Intelligencer, which is the daily newspaper for lawyers in Philadelphia. And actually, that monthly column about appellate law that is read by all of the lawyers in Philadelphia is probably a much greater source of my name recognition and the types of business I get to work on in my legal practice than my blog, which is more or less something I enjoy doing on the side. So that's what I've been doing. Becoming a solo practitioner in 2004, thankfully, been successful, and I continue to enjoy doing it. And so here we are.
That's great. What got you interested in appellate practice? Did it start with your clerkship, or was it even going back further than that?
I'd say it was during law school when I was fortunate to be on the law journal at Emory. And back then, you'd have some office hours where you'd had to be there. And it wasn't always the most exciting time to be sitting in the law journal office. And they had the softbound copies of the Federal Reporter on the shelf. What would happen would be when the library got the bound copies of the Federal Reporter, which contains federal appellate decisions, the library would move the softbound copies into the law journal offices. And so for whatever reason, probably just out of boredom, I began at some point just looking through the Federal Reporter and noticing some of these decisions are really interesting and also really well written. And the type of persuasion that was being used, even by the judges, and arguing back and forth between a dissenting opinion and a majority opinion. And so I became interested in possibly doing appellate law at that time. And because of the fact that I went straight through from high school to college to law school, by the time that I was going to be graduating law school, I was still quite young. And I was fortunate also not to have huge student loans. We're talking now about graduating in 1989. So it's not like today where you can rack up incredibly large student loans. But back then, there were limit on those. And so even though I had used student loans to get through school, it was not such a burden that I had to look for a high-paying job at that time. And so given all those considerations, I decided to apply for an appellate clerkship. And I looked at the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, the 11th Circuit, among others. And I was fortunate to get interviews on all three of the circuits that I just mentioned. And the judge who hired me was a former justice on the PA Supreme Court before President Reagan appointed him to the Third Circuit. And so that clerkship in particular really ended up being a wonderful one for what I do today, which is practicing largely in the Third Circuit and the Pennsylvania State Appellate Courts.
That was kind of going to be my next question. You know, what type of work do you do? Is it primarily civil and criminal? And I guess geographically, it sounds like you kind of focus on the Third Circuit in Pennsylvania.
Correct. And so my practice is largely civil. From time to time, I'll do a criminal appeal, but only if it's in an area that I feel comfortable. And the particular area of practice that I've managed to develop, more or less through word of mouth, thankfully, is being the go-to appellate person for plaintiff's attorneys in high dollar personal injury cases. And that's any type of case, medical malpractice, car accident, injury at the workplace. And so, you know, even though my practice is not looking to see, you know, how can I get to the U.S. Supreme Court? Although I have sat at counsel table twice in two cases that came up when I was at my first law firm and wrote the briefs in a case called Celotex versus Edwards, which is the Celotex U.S. Supreme Court case that no one's ever heard of. I think there's one that's still famous as being the summary judgment standard, but it's not this one. This is the one that involves bankruptcy and supersedious bonds, which ironically are two, at least one area that appellate lawyers care a lot about.
Oh, yeah.
And the other is highly technical, which is another thing that appellate lawyers seem to focus on a lot. And so in that case, I was tabbed to write the briefs for Celotex on behalf of a huge team of lawyers with a lot of people who knew exactly what the case was about and what was going on in these areas of law. And my side ended up winning that case 7-2 in a opinion from Chief Justice Rehnquist. But upon going on my own as a solo practitioner, that's the practice area that I've developed: plaintiff side, high value personal injury cases. Now there are other cases in which I represent companies and the like, say commercial disputes. But if it's defending a personal injury case, chances are that's not something I can take on because that would be too much of a conflict with my bread and butter practice.
You've been in practice long enough where that's an issue. You know, we talked some about in solo practice, how one of the nice things about that is not having big conflict issues. But if you're regularly and consistently representing injured plaintiffs, to be hired on the other side, is, I suppose, wouldn't be the best development for you among your plaintiff's lawyer clients.
No, absolutely. And Todd, I think that our careers to some degree do parallel one another because I see you became a solo in 2004, if I have the dates right, after spending around 10 years in practicing at a pretty big firm.
Close to me, 2006.
Okay.
But close enough, yeah.
But it's funny you should bring up the issue of conflicts because in a case where I was working on a commercial dispute on behalf of a bank that was heading to appeal, where they were suing a developer for having defaulted on a loan. I was in the background at the trial court level, meaning that I was just consulting on the case until it reached the appellate court. And at some point, I got a call on the phone in my office from the other party asking me if I could be his appellate attorney. And I didn't even know at the time if I was cleared to reveal that I was already hired by the other side because it had not been made public yet. So I had to go back to my client and say, you know, I told the guy, it's more or less a voicemail message to begin with. So I went back to my client. I said, yeah, I've been contacted by the other side. I can't represent him, but do you want me to tell him that I'm on your side or just that I can't do it? And they said, you know, you can tell him that you're on our side and that's why you can't do it. So it is a small world in that I did have at least one case that comes to mind where both sides apparently wanted to have me.
You know, you've reached a point of success in solo practice if you have both sides to litigation calling you about the same case, I'd say. That's pretty neat.
How is the legal landscape in Pennsylvania for personal injury? I know in Texas, we kind of have a wide and varied landscape on that. But, you know, generally speaking, I think we have a lot of conservative appellate courts and conservative Texas Supreme Court overall. What's it like in Pennsylvania?
I'd say in Pennsylvania, it's far more balanced. Right now, our Supreme Court has more Democratic elected justices than Republican elected justices. It's not purely a matter of political background either. One of the Republican elected justices was for quite some time married to a very successful plaintiff personal injury attorney. And so she has a lot of insight and appreciation for the law in that area and often rules in favor of the plaintiff side. But I appreciate what you're saying because a lot of Texas, a lot of these, there are wonderful plaintiff side firms in Texas. And many of these lawyers end up coming to Pennsylvania because Philadelphia, you know, I guess if you want to listen to the Chamber of Commerce, maybe a hellhole, but if you want to say it on maybe more even-handed basis, kind of, I guess, a desired forum to be in oftentimes on the plaintiff side. And so I've done many appeals for attorneys who are based in Texas. And some of my favorite memories are those cases and the wonderful outcomes that they've produced. And so I'm really happy that the sorts of cases that I've been able to work on here are not just ones that have come from local firms, which do end up sending me the bulk of my work, but also for these out-of-town lawyers who have asked around and who have been told, you know, you might want to go see this guy. He might be able to help you out.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
So when you're working with the plaintiff's lawyers, how are you structuring? Are you working on a contingent fee basis, or are you doing a flat fee kind of arrangement, or does it just depend on the case?
That's an excellent question, of course. I'm open to all different approaches depending upon what the person who has contacted me prefers. A lot of these law firms that I end up working for are very, very successful plaintiff side firms. And so it's actually more in their interest to pay me an hourly rate than to cut me in on part of the action, so to speak. Because again, these are huge. Just to pick one case, several years ago was a $54 million Acura Integra rollover case involving brain injury. And the person was, you know, unable to walk again following the accident. The question was whether the car's safety features had worked properly or not. And Acura is part of Honda. So that they went out and hired Ted Boutros of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, who is a well-known appellate attorney. And I argued the appeal against him in Pennsylvania's state intermediate appellate court, which was a ton of fun. But I, Todd, since you mentioned it, I mean, obviously being a solo practitioner, one of the wonderful things about it, in my view, is that you can offer to represent clients on a fee basis that makes sense under the circumstances. And as my wife will say, you know, Howard, why aren't you doing more cases on a contingent fee basis? Because all the ones that you have done so far have just been so wonderful. And so I've been fortunate in that a high number of the overall cases that I've accepted on a partial contingent fee basis have ended up producing results for everyone involved. And so that's been great. You know, as long as I have work to do, I mean, I'm happy. So again, you know, if they want to pay me at an hourly rate, that's great. If they want to do it on some other basis, I'm happy to consider that as well. And also, like you said, flat fee, a lot of times that does make sense. And I try to be competitive there as well when I can do so.
That is the beauty of solo practice, really, is you can do what works for your client base. And if you're like me, your client, you represent the actual, you know, party litigant, right? But your client relationship most often is with the trial lawyer.
Indeed. You know, I think that part of being a good appellate lawyer, whether you're on your own or at a firm, is being able to be someone who's easy to work with. And there's so many different aspects to that, of course. One is doing good work, obviously. The other is understanding the perspective of the people that you're trying to help. And so, you know, I've been in situations where somebody brings me in as the trial lawyer, meaning to have a meeting with me to discuss an appeal that they might like my help on. And this doesn't happen all that often anymore, but I recall it happening from time to time in the past. You know, Howard, I have a list of 80 things that the trial judge did wrong in our case. And let me just start off, you know, with these things. And of course, at some point you have to explain, you know, those 80 things are horrible, but the chances of our success here are going to be much greater if we could try to focus on the ones that are the most important and maybe, you know, the ones that have the greatest likelihood of altering the outcome if we're not happy with what that outcome is or keeping the outcome the same if we like the outcome. And so, you know, it is always an enjoyable experience to work with other attorneys. And one of the things that I enjoy the most is when, you know, they become repeat customers. And, you know, at some point it's as though, you know, they just realize that, that you know what you're doing. And so, yeah, you know, they want to look at it before it gets submitted, of course, but they're happy with your work because you've already shown them that you know what you're doing. You can get results where possible.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with those conversations. Thankfully, usually not 80 issues, but you do kind of have to have that funnel conversation. You're right. These are all crummy things that happen to you, but we're going to have to pick our best shots and go with them because, you know, once you get past a very small number, they're just not going to be interested anymore.
That's right. Well, one thing that prompted us to get in touch was you had made a comment on Twitter. I had written a tweet basically describing our mutual acquaintance, Carl Cesari, as practicing unapologetically solo. I kind of get the sense, Howard, that you fall in that same category, that you're a solo lifer, more or less. Is that the case?
Well, you know, to begin, there's not a day where I just don't thank my lucky stars that I'm able to do this sort of work. And I was very happy with the firm that I came up through after my clerkship. And then I made a move to another firm that seemed to be more financially advantageous to me and my colleagues who went there. It's a little bit difficult at a bigger firm to just show up and expect everyone to turn over their appeals to you because you're the appellate guy who just has appeared on the scene. And so at that second firm, I was running into a variety of issues. One was that the amount of work from inside the firm that I was getting there was not as much as it was at my original firm. And maybe I'll spend a second at some point explaining how things worked out so wonderfully at the start of my career at that original firm, because it's an interesting story that even involves Akin Gump to some degree back out of Dallas. But focusing now on going solo, at my new firm, fortunately, I was at a point in my career where people would be seeking to hire me from outside. So in particular, one potential new client came to me and they were representing a bank that was having a commercial dispute with another bank. And neither bank was currently a client of this firm, but I put it through the conflicts process and somebody who was representing a bank that was a client of the firm came to me and said, you know, well, Howard, you know, what if my client doesn't like the fact that this other bank is being sued by our firm in your case on behalf of this other bank? And I said, like, are you saying I can't do this case now? And he said, yeah, pretty much you can't do this case. So there came a point where I saw that I had enough work to do on one particular case. It wasn't specifically that case, that if I went and became a solo practitioner at this time, that I knew that at least for 6 months or so, that I'd have work to do. And fortunately, this was one of those cases where it actually did not settle and went through the whole process. And then, you know, thankfully the phone kept ringing. And so I realized that solo practice is not for everyone because you need to get work. And fortunately, as I was alluding to before, thanks to my appellate column and word of mouth among the plaintiffs bar in the Philadelphia area, my marketing consists of writing that monthly appellate column and answering the phone or responding to an email. And that's how it works out. Have there been times where, like, I'm sitting here wondering, you know, what am I going to do next? I mean, sure, that happens from time to time, but thankfully those periods have been few and far between and haven't lasted for extended amounts of time. And so, you know, I've been, like I said, really fortunate to be able to be successful here. And again, not to spend time talking about my wife, who's a wonderful person and who has known me since high school, but she had said to me back in 2004, you know, do you think that going out on your own is the right thing to do or not? Because you have this financial security in being at a firm. And if you're on your own, you wouldn't have that. But I'm happy to say that it really has worked out well. And you know, I've been able to keep rates at what they had been before and stay competitive in the market. And what she's been able to realize, thankfully, is that now with my overhead, which is way smaller than what it had been before, that I can work a lot fewer hours. I could coach my son's softball team. He just graduated law school himself recently. So he doesn't have a softball team anymore that I'm coaching. But when he was growing up, you know, I could be there for him and be around in a way that I couldn't if I was working at a big firm, crazy hours, spending an hour commuting back and forth to Center City, Philadelphia. My office now is 5 minutes from home, and that's the way it has been since I went solo.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
Well, you talked a little bit about your marketing and your column, but I think one of the things that people know you the most for is your blog, the How Appealing blog. How did that get started? Because you've been doing it for a long time.
It has kind of an unusual origin story in that when I was at that second firm that I came in to be the appellate partner at, the Pittsburgh-based firm, one of the associates who came with me from my original firm, who was a very smart and interesting fella, kept visiting me and saying, you know, look at this website. It's a website where law professors are talking about interesting issues in the law. And I kept brushing him off saying, why would I care about what law professors think about anything? My apologies in advance to law professors who are now tuning out of our podcast because I've changed that view. And it was the Volokh conspiracy website, which had just started a little bit earlier in 2002. And so ultimately, I did take a look at it. I thought, this is interesting. I wonder if anybody is writing any blogs about appellate law. So I did a quick search for appellate blogs, and I did not find any. I did find one from a Reed Smith partner based out in California that was a personal blog. And she was an appellate lawyer, which is why that came up in the search, but she wasn't talking about appellate things. And I figured I'd give it a shot because I'd been writing the column now for around 2 years. And from time to time, there would be topics that might not justify treatment as an entire month's topic that I thought might be fun to write about. So I just started the site. And then soon thereafter, Eugene Volokh linked to a post on my blog, and his site already had an established readership. And that caused the readership of my blog to grow. And then within a short amount of time after that, Tony Morrow, who writes for the National Law Journal, wrote an entire article about my blog in the National Law Journal. And that really caused the number of readers on my site to skyrocket. And so for a time there, I don't have it anymore, but I had, I guess it was called like a hit counter or something. You can like go in and see, you know, who's visiting your blog. And it would just blow my mind that there'd be, say, like the U.S. Supreme Court is visiting your blog. And of course, you know, I'd always think, well, you know, it's got to be Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas. You know, at a Fourth Circuit conference that I was invited to speak at, I bumped into Chief Justice Roberts. If I recall it accurately, I think he said, well, Howard, if you're here, who's writing on your blog right now? Right. And at some point, either before or after that, I had a couple of reporters who cover the U.S. Supreme Court tell me that they had interviews in Chief Justice Roberts' office, and my blog was on his computer. And you know, that was like the most mind-blowing thing of all, because I can assure you that if I had to sit there and think Chief Justice Roberts is going to read this post that I'm about to hit send on, I could never post anything because I'd be too terrified. So those are the sorts of things that I just keep out of my mind as much as possible.
Cool. How incorporated into your practice and keep up with it every day? It seems like a lot of work to kind of stay on top of that stuff.
Well, I'm fortunate, as I alluded to before, to have a very loyal and enthusiastic readership. And so commonly I will get emails or Twitter messages throughout the day. If I seem to have overlooked something or something has happened that maybe somebody would like to draw to my attention, as I'm sure you guys have seen, thanks to Twitter. You know, now it used to be when I started my blog back in 2002, there was no Twitter. But at some point in 2006, Twitter comes onto the scene and there is this wonderful appellate Twitter community that I like to think of myself as a small part of as well. That involves a lot of practitioners and journalists. And so, you know, these journalists who are much more skilled at this than I am, I think, can sign up through the PACER ECF notices so that they get instantaneous notice of court rulings even before they're posted to a court's website. So it's not unusual, as happened earlier this week, say when the First Circuit decided the Harvard affirmative action case, to see mention of it immediately on Twitter, even though the First Circuit's website hasn't posted the opinion up there yet. I've even had, on very rare occasions, judges send me an opinion that has been issued by their court that hasn't appeared on the court's website yet. And I'm sure if I went in through PACER or ECF, I could probably download it myself. So I'm not breaking any confidentiality by doing that. But it is interesting to see how people like to get noticed on my blog, and I appreciate that, you know, that people think that it's helpful to them to see their work or their article or whatever mentioned on my sites. You know, that just reinforces to me that there is some value in what I'm doing. Again, just to reiterate this, my blog has gotten me some business, but if I were to try to figure out how much time I devote to it versus how much business I get out of it, it's truly a labor of love, like I'm sure this podcast probably is for you guys. In May of 2017, my blog celebrated its 15th birthday, and I decided, just for the heck of it, to put up a post saying, you know, if people want to share their impressions of how you've liked the blog over the years or what you think about it, send me an email and I'll publish these emails over time. And so I ended up publishing one a day until the end of May 2017. And I got emails from a whole variety of folks. Adam Liptak, who covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the New York Times. William K. Souter, who was the other Souter at the U.S. Supreme Court, telling me how when he was working there, he would read my site every day, and a whole bunch of other really encouraging feedback from readers. And yet, you know, I think that having the blog allows me to indulge, for lack of a better term, my journalistic tendencies, if not doing a lot of original work, serving as kind of a clearinghouse or collection of resources for people that share similar interests with myself.
There is a fine line between blogging and journalism. You know, I remember you got in on the ground floor of the blogging wave. I mean, there was just, I think the earliest blog was like 2000, something like that. And then the law blogging trend started really even, I would say, after your blog started. It was really going great guns when I went out on my own in 2006. And actually, I wouldn't even say it was going great guns. It was still actually fairly early. It was novel, you know, when I started a blog. And to your point about judges reading them, I knew that this was important when I had a Texas Supreme Court justice pull me aside and say, "Hey, you haven't posted in a few days. Is everything okay?" And of course, you know, as I've gotten busier in my career, it's been more difficult to spend time doing that because it does take up a lot of time. But, you know, I'm surprised to hear you say, Howard, that you don't get a lot of business right off your blog. I will say that you certainly get a lot of name recognition that comes from it. And it's hard to measure the ROI on a blog because you can't say that spending this amount of time or this amount of money translates into this part of your revenue stream. But I think there's sort of an intangible benefit that is really hard to duplicate. You know, maybe you see it now in social media, like, you know, Twitter to some degree the same, but it's amazing really that you've accomplished this speed of keeping this thing up all these years, because you're quite a prolific poster and you provide a lot of information. I'm just looking at today's posts. I mean, gosh, quite a few already on some very timely topics. So it's really neat how you managed to meld your interest in journalism with the blog so that you're sort of providing, you know, that newsworthy sort of service to people about this little niche area that you work in. It's pretty cool.
Well, it's an area that has so many wonderful people practicing in it, and I've been fortunate to get to know a lot of them as the result of my site. I know that at some point we're going to talk more about Texas, and maybe I'll just launch into that right now. You know, if it wasn't for the pandemic continuing to rage out of control, I actually would be in Austin, Texas today at the Appellate Judges Education Institute conference that had been scheduled to take place there this week from Thursday to Sunday. And I was fortunate to be asked to serve on that entity's education committee starting in 2016 when it held the conference right here in Philadelphia. And I've really enjoyed being a part of that organization, and hopefully we'll be able to do it in 2021. You know, I probably would have already found my way down to Black's Barbecue in Lockhart and had a beef rib. So in some ways, it's healthier possibly that I'm not there, but I do enjoy visiting Texas. And I was also reminded of Texas just a few days ago when I got a decision in a case that I'm appellate counsel for the plaintiff from the PA Superior Court, again, Pennsylvania's Intermediate Appellate Court, in a case where Dana Livingston of Austin had argued the other side. And I guess the reason I'm mentioning this is because my side was happy with how it came out. But I was reminded of Texas again, you know, thanks to that. But it is amazing, you know, how many, just being here in Pennsylvania, how many wonderful lawyers I've been able to argue against, mostly, whether it was Lisa Blatt at the Third Circuit. She's at Williams and Connolly now. As you know, she's the attorney who has this amazing winning record at the U.S. Supreme Court. I believe she argued the first remote oral argument of the pandemic in the case involving Booking.com. The court again delivered one more ruling in her favor. She was on the opposite side of me at the Third Circuit in a case that was on a 1292B certification that my side was able to get. I mentioned Ted Boutros before Gibson Dunn. I've argued against Paul Clement at the Third Circuit. Neil Katyal was on an amicus brief against me at the PA Supreme Court. Sean Murata, who is one of the leading voices on appellate Twitter, was second chair against me in the PA Superior Court. Jay Lefkowitz is not a name that is known to everyone, but he's a U.S. Supreme Court lawyer at Kirkland & Ellis, which is now Paul Clement's firm as well. And Jay does a lot of their prescription drug preemption cases. So he had won a case involving generic preemption of prescription drug labeling at the U.S. Supreme Court. And then he came to the PA Superior Court to argue a case against me where I was on the plaintiff side. So even just staying home, I've been really fortunate to get to know and even to get to appear against many, many talented attorneys.
Well, when this episode drops, we'll be sure and tag Dana Livingston on Twitter so that she'll know that she was name dropped on this episode. She may not be happy about it, but I know Dana well enough to do that. So that's actually a pretty neat experience. And I'm really, pleasantly surprised that you've had such a deep level of experience going against Texas lawyers up there in Pennsylvania. It's true that I've seen a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers in particular who have expanded outside the state's boundaries. And there are, you mentioned Philadelphia is, I believe you used the phrase judicial hellhole. That phrase carries some meaning because there are, I can't remember if Philly was on that official list of judicial hellholes from several years ago, but there are parts of Texas that were on that list.
I think that's either the Chamber of Commerce or some other business organization that puts those lists together. So it's not my term, and it is, somewhat humorous, because I see plenty of cases here where the defendants wins at trial. And so, don't give up hope if you're on the defense side. It is possible to to do. I was mentioning earlier, how I came from the clerkship to that firm that was my first firm, and that we had this case against Akin Gump. It was interesting because this was a firm, continues to exist today, that I still have a lot of great feelings towards, called Montgomery McCracken, based in Philadelphia. And so I started working there right after my clerkship in 1991, and they had hired a class of maybe 10 or so associates. I was the only one coming in out of a appellate clerkship, if I recall correctly. And they would send newsletters once a month or so. And so I remember seeing a newsletter where it mentioned that some of the first year associates, I guess I was coming in technically as a third year associate because I did a 2-year clerkship on the Third Circuit with my judge, that some of the first year associates had started early and were already at these seemingly fancy locations in Europe on a project. And so I was thinking, well, why didn't I get sent somewhere nice in Europe? But then I get there and I find out, it was like a document review project for a medical device manufacturer client of the firm. And they were saving me to work on some appeals and other stuff that actually needed me to be in the office in Philadelphia. And so that not too long after starting work there, I was fortunate to be asked to work on a case that firm had handled on a plaintiff side contingent fee basis, which was very unusual for that firm. It was mostly a defense firm, but they had obtained a $54 million verdict for a plaintiff in a business tort case in federal court in Philadelphia. And a good amount of that money involved a punitive damages award. So the defendant was Swarovski Crystal, and they were represented by a big Philadelphia firm, maybe Morgan Lewis. I forget exactly which one, but one of the big Philadelphia firms. For their appellate case, they also brought on Akin Gump out of Dallas, Texas. And so I was asked to work on the appellate brief in that case. And they had a draft already, which I'm sure is another experience you guys have had in cases where what they did is they took all the trial court briefs and tried to like make it into this appellate brief. So it was like an 80-page document that was way over the word limit, the page limit at the time. It was just a huge mess. And so I said to the partner who had actually tried the case, instead of me trying to fix this, would it be okay if I just like took this and then created something that would be like how I would do it if I used what was in there, but just wrote it anew? And they said, that's fine. We still have plenty of time. If we don't like that, we could always go back to this. And fortunately, they did like that. And even the person who had put that monstrosity together agreed that what I had done was preferable to that. And so we ended up going more or less with what I had done. And then the case was argued somehow when I was on vacation with my wife's family and my wife in the U.S. Virgin Islands, which for the record is part of the Third Circuit, but the case is being argued back in Philadelphia. So I wasn't there to see the oral argument, but I heard about it on the phone while I was away. And then maybe 2 to 3 weeks later, and these were the days, this is maybe 2003, 2004, back when some appellate courts still did this. So we're on the winning side of trial. The Third Circuit, after the oral argument, puts down what they call a judgment order that says, upon hearing the oral argument, the briefs of the parties, the judge is affirmed. And that was the decision in a case. It was a $54 million case, had punitive damage, excessiveness questions, had a lot of questions involving, can a new business sue for loss of profits or not? So all these different cutting areas of the law. And this was at the same time that the TXO case was up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, which was another punitive damages case that the Supreme Court decided to hear out of West Virginia. And so the other side decided that they would try to ask Justice Souter for a stay of the mandate, so they didn't have to pay the judgment pending their cert petition. And I believe the motion was filed right at the end of the term, but still before the TXO decision came down. And we had to scramble to put in an opposition to that. And maybe a week later, that was denied. And then the punitive damages challenge and TXO was denied. And ultimately, cert was denied. But my client had recovered the judgment from the surety bond before cert was even denied, because there was no stay of the mandate. So that, and that was a contingent fee case for my firm. So they ended up getting maybe like a $13 million fee out of that case. And the firm was maybe 70 to 100 lawyers at the time. And that was essentially doubling the profits of every partner at the firm for that year. And so that was my first appeal that I did at that firm from start to finish. At that point, as you might imagine, you know, the partners at that firm would not hesitate and did not hesitate, thankfully, to come to me when they needed somebody to help them.
Oh my goodness. You made them all a whole lot of money that year. What an amazing outcome generally, but that basically one word opinion affirmed, you know, what would there be really for the Supreme Court to review in that situation? There's no application of the law. That's crazy, really, if you think about it.
And more recently, the Third Circuit has gotten away from deciding cases on that basis. I think you still see it sometimes now at the Federal Circuit. I don't know if it's patent cases or other cases there, but fortunately, usually for better, but maybe sometimes for worse, if you're not on the winning end, you do at least get some explanation from appellate courts. And of course, as someone who is a commentator as well as a practitioner, you know, I do appreciate that. But like you said, being on the winning end, you can't beat it.
Well, and that whole experience of being a relatively new lawyer and getting told basically to turn the prior briefing into an appellate brief. Oh, and they even did you the favor of putting together a draft for you. I mean, that would have been a half a day's project for you then, Howard. I mean, good grief.
I like to call that a Franken brief, where you just take a bunch of stuff and stick it all together and say, well, here's a brief. Well, no, not quite.
Oh, yes. We need to continue educating our trial lawyer brothers and sisters about what an appellate brief really is, because that's not it.
And really, you know, I know it's been so many years since I did my clerkship, but that was one of the lessons that was driven home to me again and again during the clerkship, is the difference that a really good brief can make as compared to one that's not very helpful at all. And then simultaneously, and again, I have nothing against big law firms, great law firms. I mean, I think that great law firms are great for a reason. But I think as practicing lawyers, we realize that any law firm's output is only as good as the people that are doing the work. And so during my clerkship, again and again, there'd be times where I'd see a brief from a law firm that I think, you know, this is a great law firm. But you read the brief, and maybe it wasn't a great brief. Again, this was from 1989 to 1991, before there was maybe as much specialization in appellate work as there is today. But even today, you know, I think in the minds of many lawyers, if you're someone whose job it is to be a litigator, you should be able to do the case from start to finish. And one of the things that we're here to try to help people appreciate is that in many cases, you can gain value by having someone who is an expert or really good at doing what we do and communicating and writing, and who understands what the judges are looking for and how to be effective. After that oral argument that I had over the Zoom call with Dana Livingston, one of my co-counsel said to me, and this really struck home with me, and again, you know, I can't appreciate this while I'm doing it, but he said to me, because he was watching over the YouTube stream, you know, Howard, I could tell when you were talking to the judges that these judges are really like listening to what you have to say intently. And this was a panel of judges who have argued before numerous times in many important cases, and some of whom I've spoken with off the bench as well. And I think that, you know, that really is special to me as a practitioner to think, you know, these judges care what I have to say. It's what you hope for, but it's nice to see it there in action.
Well, again, that I think that ties directly into the name recognition that you acquire and spending time, you know, putting out good content related to the appellate field. I mean, people associate your name with what you've been writing and knowing that they can entrust what you say. I mean, that's 75% of being a good appellate lawyer, I think, is being able to open your mouth and have the courts, you know, listen because they know that what you say is trustworthy. Yes, you're advocating a position, but you're also, you know, you're going to be true to the law or explain your reasons in a way that's more than justifiable. And hopefully you're on the winning side, but not always. Nobody bats 1,000 in this practice area. That's for sure.
Not if you do more than a few.
Credibility is huge and so important. And, you know, so often that might mean, you know, having to deal with the problem side of your case in a frank and honest way. And judges do appreciate that. Like everyone, you know, it takes time to become comfortable giving oral arguments. You know, I think that I'm still nervous from time to time when I'm about to give one, even though I've done it so many times, but I really enjoy doing it as well in the moment. And also, you know, being somebody who follows the rules that you're supposed to follow, which is, you know, if the judge opens his or her mouth, you shut your mouth. And I've been giving arguments. I've been at the other table where a Third Circuit judge will say to somebody else, you know, don't point at me while you're arguing. You know, some people get up there and have styles that just turn off the bench. And having done the clerk's, you can see what works when other people are at the podium and how, you know, maybe giving a jury speech obviously is not the way to do it on appeal, but there are so many different styles that can be effective. And I think that, you know, that was one of the things that I tried to work hard on early on, as I think Carl touched on in his appearance here, which is, you know, become a student of good writing. Read the briefs on the Solicitor General's website. Read the opinions of judges who are great writers. Read good writing in the New Yorker or other places that convey facts in an interesting way and see how to develop persuasion that is powerful without using adjectives and ad hominem attacks on people, because unfortunately, so many folks think that that's the way to do it. And obviously, it's exactly the opposite of the way to do it. We could go on forever, I have a feeling.
No, that's absolutely right, though.
Unfortunately, we are reaching the end of the time we had allotted, but I've enjoyed hearing your stories, Howard.
Absolutely. This is really interesting.
One thing we like to do is ask our guests to provide a tip or a war story. You just kind of provided a really good tip, looping back to Carl's discussion. But did you have another one that you'd like to kind of leave as your parting thought for our listeners?
I'll say that still one of the highlights of my career as an appellate advocate arguing cases at the Third Circuit. As a young associate, I was invited by a partner on a case to give an argument in a case where I wrote the briefs on behalf of Borders Bookstore. They were sued by somebody who was offended by the cover of a music CD that probably was somewhat offensive. It was by some rap group that was trying to make people angry about something. And of course, Borders Bookstore is now out of business, sadly, gone the way of many brick and mortar bookstores these days. But on the other side was Michael Smirkanish, who is now a somewhat famous individual. He has a CNN show every Saturday morning and has a radio broadcast that I think may be national, but he also had a radio broadcast for many years in Philadelphia before going national. He's somewhat of a conservative Republican commentator, but in this case, he was on the plaintiff side suing for damages and was working at a pretty well-known plaintiff side firm at the time. And so he was on the appellant side and he got up to the podium at the Third Circuit and said, "I'm Michael Smirkanish." And even by then, he was somewhat famous, definitely more famous than I was at the time. He began by saying, "You know, someday this case will be in all the First Amendment case books as a leading case involving First Amendment law." And ultimately, that case was decided by an unpublished opinion that just affirmed the judgment. And a number of years later, he had me on as a guest on a show to, I think, discuss maybe the Solomon Amendment cases up before the U.S. Supreme Court, which was a law that did not allow college campuses to uninvite military recruiters if they wanted to continue to receive federal funds, and whether that violated the First Amendment. And it was pretty funny because when he started out my appearance on the show, he said, "You know, Howard just reminded me that he beat me in my very first Third Circuit oral argument." So that's a a funny war story that shows that not every case was I the one who was the better known attorney in the room.
That is funny. Well, before we close out, will you just kind of tell people where they can find you for those that haven't seen your blog or on Twitter, on social media and stuff, where they can go to find more about you?
Sure. So my Twitter handle is at How Appealing, I believe. And my website is at howappealing.abovethelaw.com. Or if you just type the words How Appealing into your Google search engine, it should come up as the top result, which, as I was mentioning earlier, was not the case when I started it, when the top result was a lingerie company. So people can decide on their own whether that's improvement or not, whether that's progress.
Well, thank you so much, Howard. We really appreciate you joining us today. And before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot an email to us at hosts@texapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram at texapplawpod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.